Shavua Tov, ladies and gentlemen. We're continuing with our series on contemporary issues involving women in halacha. Last week we began the second of the shiurim by discussing women in Talmud Torah. We didn't quite finish. I introduced to you a very fascinating work which I had discovered just before the shiur called Feminism v'Yahadut. I wanted to come back to it very briefly. Fascinating. The book, which is a fairly recent vintage, written by Professor Weinrot, an uncle of our own Zevi Weinrot, he gave me the sefer, is copyrighted 2001. Makes reference to a 1995 work which discusses two different levels of feminism. I'm not exactly sure what this means, I'm just letting you know. It says the original feminism was against the halacha, but the newer feminism is not trying to prove that women are the same as men. The difference is that we shouldn't say that one is better than the other, and that's not against halacha. I happen to agree with him completely, if that's how you define the new feminism. However, this entire sefer, the whole work, is against what we'd call today egalitarianism. So if the new feminism includes egalitarianism, then it's still against halacha by his own work. If it doesn't, then I embrace it completely as a matter of semantics. Just wanted to just make this semantical point. And again, we spoke about the difference between men and women as he has it in this sefer, and I feel it's important to quote such a book because this is coming from a more modern source. After all, it's something which is being printed by Yediot Achronot, not quite a Frum or a Haredi institution. That's the printing, putting out the Sefer. And once again, he goes into an idea of Chochma Bina Vedas. We all know this from Chabad. He describes that Chochma is abstract, Bina is practical, and Das is putting them together to come to the bottom line, if you will. And this requires stubbornness. You have to be involved in constant work. And he writes as follows: Noshim Datan Kala, an expression we mentioned briefly last time, found in the Gemara, does not refer to women's intelligence, which is exactly the same as men, but rather, and I quote from the Hebrew, what is Das? Nechishut Ha'achlata V'hidabkut ha'ikeshet b'yisur mayon ikroni mufshat. Which is sticking to this abstract principle, not giving in, you're not being flexible. But women were given gimishut rabah more than gvarim. They were given more flexibility. They were given, women are much more flexible than men. They're not so opinionated, and they're not so stubborn, and they're not so uncompromising, and just, you know, am sheyorah, as he said. And he puts it, Noshim Datan Kala Alehen. That's the expression of the Gemara. As they put it over here, he quotes an English source. The difference between taking one's work seriously and taking oneself seriously. The first is imperative, the second is disastrous. So the women out there, they don't take themselves so seriously. Datan Kala Alehen. That's how he translates the word. Fascinating. And he gives it in another example, Datan Kala, referring to a king and a queen. They're not so care about the menu, whether you're giving them a goat or giving them a sheep and a carbon pesach. Datan kala, it means that they're flexible. Oh, I care about the menu. You give me a sheep, you give me a goat. Yeah, I have a carbon pesach. What's the difference? What it is? That's where the expression datan kala is found as well. So therefore, he explains it, does Dr. Weinrot, that a woman is much more flexible, much more, and that's what's called kalos hadas. Before we go further in this concept, and he's a very lengthy discussion of it, I want to tell you that he explains that this was given to a woman in order to enable her to better raise the children. Every child, you have to be soft, you have to be patient, you have to be sensitive, and you have to be flexible. Therefore, a woman is better equipped to raise her children. This goes back to our opening shiur, where Moshe Feinstein said that she's better able to raise children. That's why she's exempt from certain mitzvahs, Talmud Torah, full time, and Mrs. Asay Shazman Gurama. This is what it, that's all it means. The different personalities. The different personalities, no one is greater, no one is lesser. That's what it means. And when the Gemara expression that a woman is more talented in, with her hands, it means that it, she has a better ability to do these things and to be the housekeeper, homemaker as they call it today. She's more practical. This doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with her intelligence. It's a different kind of sensitivity which she has, which men don't have. Interestingly, I'm quoting it from this sefer again, Feminism V'Yahadut by Dr. Avi Weinroth. He quotes something which is an amazing thing. There are more rights in Shulchan Aruch, in Yoredeus, in Kuf Chav Zayin, Sif Gimel, and I think it's worthwhile actually taking it out just to read it. Always good to hear things from the actual inside in the Hebrew. Well, it's quite a remarkable line, but you know, again, people take offense to everything, but we have to follow our traditional sources. It discusses that women have credibility for this and credibility for that. We spoke about this in our opening shiur. That's only if it's certainly prohibited. So she says, no is no. She understands that. Out of the suffix, shema ein kan yisur, not so clear, right? Or it's tadim lahakel, the reasons to be lenient. Ein isha nemenes. You cannot give a woman credibility. Why? Look at this expression. The isha data kala lahakel. Same thing. She's flexible. She's more given to compromises. Sometimes the compromise is wrong. Sometimes it's right. Sometimes it's wrong. We're fearful that the woman may compromise where it's inappropriate. And therefore, the Ramah, who's our highest authority, says that we have to take a step back and be cognizant of the words of our Chachamim. This is something which is, it rings throughout the generations. The Chavetz Chaim, who was the one who we quoted at great length last week, who made a revolutionary change in women's education, says explicitly that women should not be rulers in matters of halacha. Presumably he's basing himself on the words of the Ramah. Again, not that she's any less intelligent, she has a different kind of personality. And, as he points it out over here, why is a woman exempted from this full-time requirement to learn? It's going to put herself in conflict with her other responsibilities. She wants to do other things. She wants to raise her family. It's a conflict. We try to stay away from conflicts in life. We're not trying to put someone in a difficult position. And therefore, she is exempt from this full-time occupation of Talmud Torah. Although she can volunteer, right? But she's volunteering. She's always under a conflict. And therefore, she has a greater chance of making a mistake. Because she's not as completely single-minded about studying the Torah in its depth and its breadth. Because she has other commitments in life. This is how he explains it. As a matter of fact, what he says here, coming from he's obviously an observant Jew, but he's coming from the university, from Bar Ilan University, that's where he's coming from. Almost the same interpretation, verbatim, in the expression of Noshim Datam Kala, is given by a person coming from a completely different place. He is a Rosh Hashiva of Neri Yisrael in Baltimore. He wrote a book, Rabbi Aaron Feldman wrote a book called The River, the Kettle, and the Bird. Who's ever heard of it? It's written for men. But I recommend that women read it also. It's fascinating. You ever see it?
Fabulous.
He explains the same thing. He gives the following example. Now, all the men are going to laugh, but this is his example. As a man saw his wife was having a hard time, he said, you know, honey, you know, you can go out to have a good time. For 3 hours, I'll take care of the family. I'll take care of, you know, the kids and the whole story. I'll take care of the house and the whole story. You can hold yourself by the size, shouldn't, you know, collapse laughing and stitches. It's somebody, he starts to describe what the guy does. Okay, so the first thing is, the kid makes a mess, he has to go pick it up. Then he has to go into the kitchen because he knows that it's going to burn the soup. So he has to go first. Then the kid has to have a diaper change. And then the kid has to do the homework. And then, after an hour, he is dead. The guy is a shmata, he's a rag. He can't do it. Why? Because it's much harder for a man to go from place to place to place to place. Quotes the Gemara, that the Gemara tells us that when the people are traveling, it's harder for a man to travel than for a woman. She's used to it. That and Kala means she's light on her feet. So she can go here, and then she can go there. Whoever's run a household, and there are quite a few people on this side of the aisle who run house, know what I'm talking about. You're going from here to there to there to here, and you're so nimble and so able to do it. But people like me can't do it. We're used to doing one thing, and I want to focus on this one thing, and in 3 hours I'm going to focus on something else. That's what he says. So it's almost the same as he's talking about flexibility. It's just about the same point of view of the comment. Both of them are concerned that women in their studying Torah were not going to reach the correct conclusion precisely because of their inability, again, he's talking generalities, because of conflicting values and personalities. We know, we believe HaKadosh Baruch Hu created every person with the ability to do what he or she is supposed to do. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu created them, according to this book, after the Chait of Chava and Adam and Rishon. I'm not going into that right now, again. But whatever reason, if it's a different personality, and therefore, because how do I know this? Rabbi Feldman wrote a whole mimer, printed in the most recent book, which he's very upset with, a book called Women's Learning, which was published a while ago. And he tries to mix it, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. This, he goes to a whole litany, what's wrong? What's he spending so much time? He's trying to point out that it's difficult, given his whole mahalach, for them to reach the proper conclusion. Rabbi Shechter Shalita, in a fascinating presentation to the Rabbinical Council of America, some, I think, 7.5 years ago, goes the other way. With the same fundamental point, he's afraid, to the contrary, that aside from the woman maybe getting the Torah a little bit wrong, she may, in his words, lose her femininity. Let me explain what he says. Is that studying Torah in depth is a war. It's a war. And he gives the following fascinating vignette. A non-Jew happened to be on the train that was going through Russia with the Mir Yeshiva. As you know, the unbelievable escape that they went from the Mir in Europe, went all the way to the other end of China and Japan. So he says that a non-Jew was on, he wrote his own memoirs. He says, these boys, he doesn't understand what's going on over there. Had these big books. When they had these big books, they took out the big books, they're yelling and screaming at each other like crazy. Like they're the worst enemies. Then they put away the big books and they came to eat lunch. And they're best friends, and they're nice to each other, and it's fantastic, and it's beautiful. They take out the big books, they're yelling, and they're screaming. And so Rabbi Shechter said he understands where it's coming from, because it's a Gemara, an explicit Gemara. The Gemara says, on the Pasuk, as Vayiv B'Sufa, that even a father and son, who are arguing when it comes to Torah, they have become enemies to one another. That's the expression of the Gemara, enemies. Fathers and enemies? Yeah, because they're fighting, in the Milchamta Shel Torah, the war of Torah, the war of words, and each one is very stubborn that his position is correct. And but when they finish, Nasu Oavim Zelazet, they love one another. That's exactly what happened with the big books. They were at war with each other. When they put away the big books, so Rabbi Shechter said he's afraid that if the women are given the big books and they develop this kind of a personality of being bellicose and warlike, it's not always so easy to put away the big books and go back to the original personalities. Men also sometimes, they learn yeshivas to become belligerent and they're unable to parse their personalities, the belligerence of the Beis Medrash to being nice outside. So he's afraid when it comes to women who have their more feminine nature, it may even be worse. Either way, whether it's you worry about this one, you worry about that one, you would ask an obvious question. What about other careers? What about women who are lawyers? It's the same issues. It's very adversarial. So, it can either, if she's going to be involved with her family, it can take away sometimes from her ability in the law profession. We've seen this happen. She gets off the fast track to have a baby or two, and it's hard to get back on again. We know this. Or the other way around, if she's all in law, she may lose her femininity either by not having children or not treating her children properly. We spoke last time about raising her own children. So Rabbi Shechter said, you're right. He asked him this question at that presentation. He said, you're right. It's also a problem. And he quoted from Rav Kook. Rav Kook is known as the modern man, Rav Kook. Everyone, Rav Kook, the chief rabbi of Israel, a very modern rabbi, right? He is the one who said, he thinks that in order for Eretz Yisrael to reach the proper geula, to go back to the original traditions, that the women were raising their children, and he was unhappy with the fact that, if you knew this is of Israel in his time, 100 years ago, they were going into the outside world too much for his liking. He was unhappy with it. I've seen, frankly, I remember one particular case, there was a certain fine young lady, that she ended up in this somehow in the commodities exchange. It has something to do with our community as well, for those who may know. And before you turn around, she almost was coming masculine. Her voice changed. A very sweet voice, it was a gruff voice. Because she was screaming and yelling. Did you know the Comex? You could scream and yell on a bar. Ah! Well, I was so scared. Baruch Hashem, she found a husband. She got married. Now her children come and learn with us. Thank you. She's back to...
The voice is back.
The voice, her regular voice is back. A sweet lady. Yes?
I've had a lot of trouble with this discussion.
Good.
It is
your
advice. And I think that there are also a lot of women who weren't raised with the tools to be the parents of mothers-in-laws. And so, in fact, if you take it back, if you don't have the tools, then how do you do it? Then there are an awful lot of women who feel inadequate. And the other, that's one thing. The other thing is, in terms of women's learning, Dina and I were very involved in Shir, and I unfortunately had to leave. The two of us, it wasn't like men, but it was so stimulating. Women need to be stimulated in their learning, and there needs to be give and take, and this is something that I feel is really missing.
Okay, so you're giving it. You're giving me, and I'm taking it. So that's no problem. That's give and take.
I have no problem. And I have spoken a lot about it.
I have no problem.
Because this whole, all of the controversy that's going on is happening. I think it's a wake up call that rabbis need to listen to what women have to say, and mm-hmm. women also have to say what they have to say to rabbis in a way that's consistent with halacha.
100%.
So I think that if we can use all this for something that is happening, which is it's happening for a reason, and I think it's important to pay attention.
I'm paying very close attention, as you can see. The question, of course, becomes what is the proper way to go? I will tell you, as a matter of fact, that I'm not necessarily endorsing Rabbi Cook's position. Not because of the lack of respect for Rav Cook. Rav Cook is a giant, doesn't need my endorsement. But if you look at towards the end of this beautiful work by Dr. Weinrapp, look what he quotes over here. It's just a shout. Things can change. I'm endorsing your position right now. Page 104 of this book, towards the end, he has something incredible. He says that, you know, three of the greatest giants of the Jewish world of 100 years ago, who are they? Rabbi Cook. Rabbi Chaim Oizer of Vilna, who was the greatest of all the practicing rabbis of the time. And the Chafetz Chaim, who was the greatest of all the rabbinic decisors of his time. All three of them came out in their time that women should not vote. Black and white. That's what I'm reading, and I haven't.
No,
he thinks the same way.
Yeah.
Okay. That's exactly the point, Ben. That's exactly the point. He said that if women are going to start voting, there'll be fights in the family. He's a Republican and she's a Democrat. This is what they were worried about. Exactly. This is exactly what he said. And Rav Cook went further than that. And I'm going to read you some of Rav Cook's position as explained in this work towards the end, 10 pages later approximately. And of course it's like this: the family is the most important thing. Beis Yaakov, which means the Jewish women will build Am Yisrael. We want to build, this is what I was going before, we want to build a people based upon our own nature. And the whatever one now wants the woman to go out of the house. And when we ask the woman to go out of the house, lirushut ha'arabim ha'medinit, to the public square, and she's going to get tistabeh, she'll get involved in all kinds of svach, complications, explaining her positions about the elections and about politics. What's going to happen? She's going to start becoming a politician. And we're taking away her inner values and her ability to be a private person. Or, exactly what you said, to be a promise shalom bias. What he means, right? She'll be, I don't know, different experience. It was Beitar and Avodah, you know, whatever, different, they were called different things at different times. There'll be different parts of the political spectrum. You're fighting the family. Rav Cook was very worried about this. Says this author, quoting from earlier people, Rav Cook said it, and he really meant it. He wrote it more than one time. Many quotes, many, many sources from Rav Cook. and from other great people. And yet he says, I think it's completely correct, it's water under the bridge. Today, there's absolutely no rabbi that he could find anywhere who will say that a woman shouldn't vote. Not even one. Not one. Not one. So what happened? What changed? I'll tell you what changed. What changed is that if a woman are not going to vote, the Orthodox community will get schmeist. It's bad enough when the women vote. There's still only a small spread. So they decided, you know, really it would be better, ideally, they shouldn't vote. They haven't changed their minds on that. But practically speaking, you're going to go out and vote. This way you double your votes. We hope that they'll vote on the same ballot, the same ticket. That's what they said. They hope they'll vote for the same thing. Okay, so we take chances on all this kind of stuff. But just give an example how things can change. As I'm the first to say that my position on the women in Talmud Torah, which I spoke about at length last week, one of the things I quoted, if you remember, was the Dayan of Belz, who, in going against the Kloisenberger and the Satmar Rebbes, who was so much against women learning anything to do with Torah, they only learned there with Tzadarenes, he said, look, we have 50 years of experience that it works. It works, and if it works, it works. He was saying, even if you assume there was a prohibition, I told you last week there's no prohibition, there never was any prohibition. Just that, you had to do, you know, follow the customs that we had before. Tzivu Chachamim, they gave you advice not to do it. Okay, 50 years of experience under our belt, so now we understand that it's okay to do it. And if we're going a little bit past the Beis Yaakov's, in our quote-unquote Michlala type of school, which we mentioned the last time, which I'm a major fan of, my three daughters went there, that's not a Beis Yaakov, they're more, I guess, I don't know how to say it properly, they're just different than the Beis Yaakov, is someone in their orientation. Okay, Michlala has also been around for 40-something years, and I've seen the alumni over. Once we get to the ones who are more avant-garde, these new midrashot with their whole base medrash amos, which we spoke about a little bit last time, where there is even a breakdown of the how, as I call it, the educational ritual divide, which I think is critical to maintain. That gives me pause. Again, I'm only speaking from my perspective today. In 20 years, or 50 years, or 100 years, they say we sometimes laugh. Women shouldn't vote. We're 100 years later after this happened. 100 years. 100 years from now, they may laugh at what I'm saying now. I say, well, Shugner said in the year 2010, in 2021-10, I'll say, some crazy guy said something, and they'll pull out some tape of what I'm saying over here, and they'll say, well, crazy guy. Fine! I mean, if I'm proven crazy at that time, they'll say, I was crazy. So things do change with the times, but nonetheless, this does not relieve us of our responsibility of expressing a point of view to the best of our ability in the present time and the present place. That's how I summarize this issue. I'm ready to start now. This week's topic. I'm already almost halfway done and I'm already behind, so forgive me. This week's topic is women in tefillah. Now, women in tefillah is an entirely different topic of a totally different nature. Let's begin by discussing what is a woman's obligation to pray. Is a woman obligated or not obligated? So, to be very brief, the Mishnah tells us that women are obligated to pray. Nonetheless, there's a major dispute between the Rambam and Rashi as to what the nature of this obligation. And the obvious problem is that prayer, as we know it, is the classical mitzvah asei shazman grama, shachris, mincha, and ma'arif. Women are exempt from these types of obligations. So why suddenly are they obligated in tefillah? That's a good question. And there are two texts in the Gemara, in the Sefta Brachos on Daf Chaf Amud Beis, with completely different and divergent results. According to the text which we have, although it's in parentheses, the Gemara says, Rachmehu. You're right, it's a Zman Garama, but it's an exception to the rule. Why is it an exception to the rule? Because women need Hashem's mercy the same as men. So though technically speaking they really should have been exempt because it's Zman Garama, nonetheless, the Halacha obligates them because... that's all over again. The Halacha obligates them because they require Hashem's mercy. This is the Girsa of Rashi. This being the case, they're obligated to daven Shachris, obligated to daven Mincha, Ma'ariv. So Ma'ariv, even for men, is technically speaking a Rishus, is optional. Men have accepted it as an obligation, women have not. As the Mishnah Berurah suggests, fine. But Shachris and Mincha for sure. The Rambam has a completely different text. He just says, Kamash Malon. What does Kamash Malon mean? That women are only obligated... No, let me say it better. Kamash Malon, that it's not a Zman Grum. Tefillah is not time dependent. What does that mean? Ram didn't know about Shachris, Mincha, and Ma'ariv? Here's the answer. The Rambam is the minority view amongst the Rishonim, maintains there's an obligation to pray every single day. By Torah law. By Torah law.
Whole day.
Not the whole day. Once a day. What does this tefillah consist of? Any time of the day. It consists of three fundamental components. Shevach, Bakosha, Hodah. Praise of Hashem, supplication to Hashem, and thanking Hashem. That's it. Whoever does those three in any way, shape, or form has fulfilled his or her Torah obligation. This is not Zman Gerama, not time dependent. It could be any time of the day or night. Any time. Therefore, quote the Rambam, women are obligated in that level of obligation. No more. Quote the Rambam, women are obligated to daven Shacharis, not obligated to daven Mincha, certainly not Ma'ariv. All they're supposed to do on a given day is have a Shevach, a Bakosha, and a Hodah in one way, shape, or form. The Mogen Avraham, who is the classical Pirish on the Shulchan Aruch, the Shulchan Aruch quotes the Rambam, says, well, the women in the morning, when they wash their hands, they have some kind of a tchina, they pray for certain things, and they make a bracha of al natila sedayim, which is a shevach, and they say modani, which is a hodah. He doesn't go exactly into that, but that's what it means. Someone in the middle of every morning, a woman says enough things when she gets up in the morning, and she's discharged her obligation by Torah law in this fashion. Also say more brachas in the morning, it's even better. That's it. So what's the Mogen Avraham? The Mishnah Berurah, in contrast, says, you know, it's true, the Shulchan Aruch says this, and the Mogen Avraham says this, but I think that since Rashi and others disagree, it's better for women to daven at least Shacharis and Mincha each and every day. So you have, again, on the one side you have the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch and the Mogen Avraham. On the other side you have Rashi, you have the Ramban, you have the Mishnah Berurah. So it's no doubt in my mind that the custom of women from time immemorial was to adopt the position of the Shulchan Aruch, and they did not daven twice a day on a regular basis. However, since the Chafetz Chaim wrote his classic work Mishnah Berurah, and since the times have changed, as I said before, many, many more women have accepted upon themselves to daven once a day or twice a day Shmon Esrei, and I applaud it. Fascinatingly, in the biography of the Mishnah Berurah, written by his son, not by any outsider, a newspaper man, his son writes as follows. Yes, it's true that in the Mishnah Berurah my father wrote that a woman should daven Shmona here twice a day. But as far as I can recall, for as long as my mother was raising us, her children, she never davened. And we asked her, and she said, Abba said, or Tati said, I'm exempt. I'm busy taking care of my family. So he's writing, in Mishnah Berurah's writing, women should pray twice a day, Shmona Esrei, but in his own house, when his own wife was raising the children, he said, you're exempt, you're busy. Because, you know, we've seen Tom many women with Davin, and the kid screams, and it's she was busy. Yeah, a house full of children, busy. Didn't have outside help, she was exempt. Okay, how can it be? But Rachami, the answer is, we have a general principle, Othig mitzvah, potom and mitzvah, someone who's busy with other mitzvahs is exempt. And she's busy with this overarching mitzvah, which according to Rav Moshe, as we said 2 weeks ago, is the most important thing that a woman has to do, is to raise a family. So he exempted on a practical basis. Fine, this is as far as regular davening is concerned. Fine. So now today, connecting the two, we have women's schools. So all girls are going to women's schools. So do they daven there? Absolutely. I don't know of a single school that I know about that then women don't daven in the school. I mean, I'm not discussing practical considerations today. Today, do they daven at home? Do they daven in school? Most girls' schools, that I know, they daven in school. Am I correct? When you went to school, they daven in school? What? Okay. So they daven, of course, by themselves. They have a chazanit, usually. You had a chazanit when you went in? Some kind of a woman who sat in front and she led the services, correct? This is always true. If I'm not mistaken, Mr. Shabbos' daughter wrote a letter once to to one of the newspapers who was... There's a little revisionist history. And they said the boys, it never happened. She said, women didn't happen. I was there. Remember that letter? Don't tell me it didn't happen. I was there. Yeah? I don't want to say exactly. But okay. I don't like revisionist history. And I'm okay with that. I have no problem whatsoever. So the question is, and it's been asked many times, so why do I oppose women's tefillah? Let me tell you what women's tefillah is. I'm not sure if anyone even knows what it means. Women's tefillah is something which started some 30 years ago approximately. The women decided We don't want to be spectators behind the mechitza somewhere. We want to have our own minyan. Those who use the word minyan use it loosely, and they use what women's prayer or whatever term that was being used. And it goes back now. It's just about now in the month of Kislev. Almost to the day. It is, I believe, 26 years ago that I was one of five rabbanim who signed a brief manifesto opposing this innovation. Okay? At that time, Rabbi Shechter Shalita wrote a long article explaining his... I just saw my name. I only wrote two words, my name. But Rabbi Shechter wrote a lengthy article, which is the... and it's later printed in the Sefer Ikvei Atzon. It's what we call the title track. Simon Hay, it's called Tzilach Ikvei Atzon, which is a many-page article in which he explains his reservations with the issue of the women starting their own tefillah service. You know what? First of all, it's not like they're going to a girls' school. To go to a girls' school, of course they're going to daven in the girls' school. They're not going to go to the boys' school to daven. But if they're going to a shul, and they're going to just go downstairs to a different room, we call it a secession. You know, the South seceded from the Union. They're going to secede from the main shul. They want to daven. Yes, sir.
It might also be in the Moses Kodesh.
Oh, Michael, I tell you, you're even more strict than Rabbi Shechter. I don't know, because he has a whole multi-page article. His thing spans about 15 pages. And he has many reasons why he thinks it's a problem. I don't think he mentioned those discussions. I have to look more carefully. Maybe. He's going to make up a separate gehillah for an insufficient purpose. And he's explaining that they're missing tefillah b'tzibur, which even they're not obligated, but you're already there to walk out on it. They miss all the various dvarim shebekedusha. He feels it's incorrect. And not only that, unfortunately, and here's the real issue, and I'll tell you a personal story. When this happened, I was one of the signatories on this brief manifesto, which Rabbi Shechter quotes in his Sefer. I'm signed with him and with three others, Rabbis Parnas and Braunschweigel, Shalita, who have since left our yeshiva and have gone to Landers, and the late Rabbi Alpert, who passed away not long after this was done. And it's interesting how it came about. This was a response, this brief response was to Rabbi Louis Bernstein, Zichrono Livracha. He was the president of the Rabbinical Council. And he had a debate just about two blocks from here. I'm not going to say exactly where. About two blocks from here, he had a debate with a sitting rabbi. And it got a little bit testy. And he was very upset with the results. He said, "What's going on over here? They let this women's tefillah thing stand." He was an old-time rabbi. He wasn't... such a great major Talmud Chacham, but he had good instincts, and he understood very well. He grew up in a different age, and he didn't like this new stuff. So he turned to us at the time for a response, and it signed Yud Tes Kislev, which was just a couple of days ago, Tav Shin Mem Hey. That's 26 years ago, and the five signatures. Okay, so shortly, a short time after this happened, some women wanted to meet with me. They were from the Washington Heights Women's Tefillah. I said, "You know, I'm happy to meet with you. I'm always ready to listen." So guess how many women came in? You're not going to believe it. 10. Exactly. 10. 10 women came in, I kid you not. And they sat in a room in yeshiva. I remember distinctly. I remember what we were learning. I remember I gave a test to my students. And I sat in the next room, talking to them for an hour or two. And they were like, what are my objections? Etc. So I said, let's start from the beginning. Why must you have a Sefer Torah? That was the main bone of contention. To the best of my knowledge, all these women's prayer groups, to my knowledge, and I'll explain to you in a minute where I lack a little bit of knowledge, have a so-called Kriyas HaTorah. Now that's supposed to be next week's topic. I don't want to take away from next week. Next week we're not meeting. It's Hanukkah. 2 weeks from now, Kriyas HaTorah. It's not really Kriyas HaTorah. We'll get to the details of Mitzvah Shem. I said, "What do you need that for?" So one of them piped up, "You know, we feel if we prepare the Kriyas HaTorah, will enable us to understand the Chumash better. Because, you know, if you know the Tamei HaMikra, you know, the Chumash better. It's, and I said, I'm 100% in agreement. I think it's a wonderful thing to know the Tamei HaMikra. And I know some women who, in their youth, studied Tamei HaMikra in their day schools. The chop, the cantillations, right? And if you know the cantillations and the vowelizations, you're able to read properly, even though you don't have the, you know, the R printed Chumash, which gives you the cantillations and gives you the vowelizations, but a Sefer Torah doesn't give it to you. You're able to master the ability to read from it without the crutch, if you will, of the cantillations and vowelizations in front of you. You have a better appreciation of the Torah. I said, that's a fantastic idea. I think it's a great idea. Take what we call in our language a tikkun. Those don't know what a tikkun is. A tikkun has half is with the cantillations and vowelizations. The other half gives you the Torah script. And read from this. Read from the tikkun. It accomplishes exactly the same thing. Rabbi, we want to have a Sefer Torah. Okay. So this, what it means is that they're trying to create, I may use the expression, an ersatz Kriyas HaTorah. It's not really Kriyas HaTorah, because Kriyas HaTorah has to have 10 men and the whole story. But it resembles it. This resemblance, according to Rabbi Shechter's perspective, is something that's called a Ziyuf HaTorah, which means that it's not an accurate representation of what the Torah is. It just doesn't give the proper presentation of what a Torah is, and then therefore it's incorrect. I'm going to go further than that. I'm skipping most of what this article says. It's so long. But a critical issue, something I've spoken about in different contexts many times, is that, you know, when you want to change something, you have to have a completely lishma, which means no ulterior motive, as the background for this change. The source for this, among others, is the Netziv. The Netziv teaches us that when you're studying the Torah in its present form, even if you do it shalom lishma, with ulterior motives, you want to become a rabbi, you'll make a good living, they'll call you a rabbi, I don't know, whatever you want to call, they'll call you Rosh Hashiva, whatever. It's not ideal, but it's okay. It's okay. You're studying the HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah. Even if you have an ulterior motive, it's okay. As a matter of fact, the expression of the Gemara is la'olam. It always should be done that way. Why? The Mefarshim explained. Mitov shelo lishma, the Gemara says, bo lishma, through the lo lishma, again lishma. And there's a fascinating explanation. The Gemara says, if you bump into the satan, the maneuver, mashcheil the beis medish. What does it mean? You pull the Eitz Hara into the beis medish. The Eitz Hara is trying to make you to have wrong motivations. Okay, come on, Rav Yitzhar, welcome into the beis medish. And after you learn Torah enough, yeah, you'll forget the Eitz Hara and his bad motivations. You'll have a proper motivation. That's fine. If you're learning Torah, if you're doing mitzvah, I'm going to do a mitzvah, and I'm going to take, I don't know, the fanciest esrog, and my motivation is completely impure. I'm going to see what, I'm just showing it off. Very wrong motivation, very wrong. Okay, I'm not condoning it, it's bad, but you should do it, because, you know, hopefully you'll get used to, the doing the mitzvah properly, and you'll hopefully have a better motivation. That's only the old time religion. Lo'olam yasok adam. You should involve yourself in the Torah and in the mitzvahs. Shalom lishma. But, says the Gemara, ha'oseh shalom lishma. What is ha'oseh? Oseh means someone who is mechadesh, who innovates. If you innovate something that's not completely lishma, that is a disaster. The Gemara says, noach lo shalom nivra. Bet he should never have been born. That's a very powerful expression. Because he, in creating new Torah and new mitzvah practices, which have never been done before, and you're not completely lishma, now not completely with a perfect motive, a major, major problem. Major, major problem. Because you don't know. You don't know what's going to come out of these things. It's a very serious issue. Very serious problem. Similar ideas are expressed by other Gedolim in different cases. I'm going to take a liberty of giving you a, since we're not meeting next week, my Chanukah Drasha. Okay? Chanukah Drasha is along these lines. The Medrash Tanchuma tells us that a person shouldn't say that I will not light Chanukah Lucht. Why should I light Chanukah Lucht? It's not in the Torah. No, it's a mistake. You shouldn't think that way. Why shouldn't you think that way? Because we find that great rabbis, even if they make innovations which are against the prevailing custom, often HaKadosh Baruch Hu will endorse their innovations. What is the source? Where is this Tanchuma found? In Parshas Noso, which we read on Hanukkah, and it's talking about the change that Yaakov Avinu made originally. As you all know, we're going to read it in upcoming Parshas, when Yaakov gave a bracha to Ephraim and Menashe, what did he do? Put his right hand on the younger one. Oh, and Yosef was very upset. What are you doing over here? See, he did it anyway. Didn't listen to his son. Where do we find that Hashem endorsed what Yaakov did? Where do you find it? Simple. On the seventh day, Hashem asked Ephraim to offer the sacrifice. And on the eighth day, he asked Menashe to offer the sacrifice. So what do you see? The Kodesh Baruch Hu endorsed the change in birth order that had been suggested so many years earlier by Yaakov Avinu. So therefore, the same reason, if our sages later on created Chanukah, you should also follow the mitzvah of Chanukah. Okay, very nice, very nice. It makes sense on a superficial level as well. Let's get a little bit more deep into understand why they picked this example of Ephraim and Menashe. Why they picked this example? Let me explain to you what I think. You know, and this is an part of the answer to Shelley's question. You know that the two brothers, Ephraim and Menashe, are two paradigms. As we all know, every person in the Brash is a paradigm. Ephraim is the man who studies Torah all day. How do we know this? Rashi in Parshas Vayechi says that they told Yosef, your father is sick. Who told him? Ephraim. How did Ephraim know? Because he was Rogel Etzel Yaakov Avinu B'Talmud. He was learning with his grandfather all day long. So he was a Talmud scholar. He was Ephraim. Menashe, we're going to read this upcoming week's Parsha. Parsha is Miketz. He was a statesman, a diplomat, the court interpreter. Hamelitz Beinosam. Rashi says this is Menashe. They have different roles in life. So in explaining and defending himself to his son Yosef, who wanted him to put Menashe first, he says, no, I know my dear son Yosef. I know that Menashe is going to be great, but Ephraim is going to even be greater. Says Rashi, it refers not only to these two individuals themselves, but to their progeny, their respective, maybe you say, greatest of all descendants. Who was the greatest descendant of Menashe, says Rashi? Gidon, the famous warrior Gidon in Sefer Shoftim. And who was the most prominent descendant of Ephraim? Yoshua ben Nun. Yoshua, the famous Yoshua. Moshe Kibbutz Torah, Mistin Mesorah, Yoshua. Fine. So what does this represent? So perhaps it means as follows. Gidon was the warrior about whom it is said in Shoftim, Lech b'chochacho zev oshat as Yisrael. Go with your own strength and your own strategies. Gidon was an individual who was outnumbered, woefully outnumbered. So what did he do? If you know the story of Sefer Shoftim, ever learned Shoftim? He took some pitchers and some lanterns and some shofars. He made a lot of noise. And he and all the enemy thought there must be thousands upon thousands of who knows how many troops about. They all ran away. It was a bluff. Okay, but it worked. That means it was an innovation, which you have to innovate in war. If you're not innovating in war, you're dead. You know, in 48, there was a thing called the Davidka. You know, they still have a Kika Davidka in your shrine. You know what Davidka was? It was Gidon all over again. Bluff! It was not there. They had no guns. Now, if you think the enemy would find out about it, they'd fall for the second time. If Gidon made the same thing after they were up in the London School of Strategic Studies, Gidon outwitted his enemy. He only had 300 men, but they made a lot of noise and they put out, and then they have another fight. What? You think Gidon would win a second time? No way! You have to have another strategy. You have to always be ahead of the game in war. Always. If you fight the last war, you lose. That's how they say it. Why did Israel have problems in the Yom Kippur War? They fought the last war, 67. They didn't know about the SAM missiles. For those who know the terrible history, it cost thousands of lives. Thousands of Jewish lives were lost because Israel didn't know about the SAM missiles that the Russians had given the Egyptians. I'm not talking to Bekitza, for those who know. Thousands of lives, of course, they fought the last war. And we only, at the end, prevailed Benissim. You can't fight the last war. And the truth is, it's not only in war. It's in all worldly matters. You know, I look around and I think, what were our great grandparents? What were their professions? Think about what were their professions? Maybe they were something with tailors and cobblers, a dairy, a grocery, that's what it was. A little store. Today, we're being a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant, a psychologist, totally different professions. Why don't you just follow what your great grandfather did? The answer is you won't be able to eat. You have to change profession. I always say, the computers, how many years are they obsolete? You fill in the blank. You know, they keep getting new and new and new chips, and everyone knows new phones. I don't even know all the words for them. Things become obsolete, and there's always new ones. There's nothing wrong with that. In worldly matters, it's always innovation is the name of the game. And that is Menashe. That is Gino. Ephraim is the other way around. Ephraim represents Torah. In Torah, give me the old time religion. We very rarely make a change in our Torah. It happens, we spoke about it already. But fundamentally, we're trying to recapture Mamad Har Sinai, the divine revelation at Sinai. That's our main objective. And therefore, who is Yoshua? Who is Yoshua? Who is he? He's the opposite of Gideon. The exact opposite. Who's Yoshua? Says the Gemara, Pnei Moshe ke Pnei Chama, Pnei Yoshua ke Pnei Levana. Moses' face was like the sun, and Joshua like the moon. Doesn't just mean that Moses was greater. But what it means? What is the moon? It's the reflection of the sun. He was trying to reflect the glory of his master. That was Yoshua. That was Yoshua. So that's what he's saying. That there are different strokes for different folks. Right? Ephraim is a totally different than Menashe. And Ephraim is greater in the sense that for us the Torah is more important than the worldly matters in principle. Let me take it a step further. This coming Shabbos, again, there's no shiur next week, so I'm telling you now. This coming Shabbos, we're going to read the etymology of the naming of these two great people, Menashe and Ephraim. The first one is called Menashe. You know why? Ki nashani Elokim es kol amoli ves kol beis avi. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me to forget all the problems I had and to move on. No, Hashem means to forget and to move on. That's exactly it. The name itself represents what Menashe is all about. In worldly matters, you have to forget and move on. Innovation all the time. And what's Ephraim? Ki Ephraini Elokim be eretz ani. God, I be fruitful in the land of my oppression. What is fruitful? What's a fruit? What's a fruit? The apple that I ate this week is the same apple that I had in Gan Eden. It's just a grandson, you know? Came straight down. I hope they don't play with it. And I want the old time apples. Right? That's it. The fruit's not supposed to fall far from the tree. It's the same fruit. Because when it comes to the world of Torah, we believe in... Oh, now I understand back to Medrash. When Yaakov Avinu took the bold step of putting Ephraim before Menashe, Hashem responded positively, did the same thing. Because you know why? Yaakov is called the Yisrael Saba. That means he's the grandfather, the ultimate grandfather in Klal Yisrael, is Yaakov Avinu, as we see right over here, in his relationship between Ephraim and Menashe. That's the first grandfather-grandchild relationship ever found in Tanakh. You don't find another one. He's the ultimate grandfather. He's the grandfather who represents keeping the old time religion, keeping these things the same as they always were. If he made a change, Hashem endorses the change. If our rabbis were not given to innovation, if they decided the story of Chanukah was so important that we have to establish an obligation to light candles for 8 days, you better believe it, and you better follow it, and you better go with it. This is it's not just something which is an example of following the rabbis. It's on point. It's exactly the same thing. Following the rabbis in this area, we're discussing innovation as opposed to going back to the old way. So with the Chofetz Chaim, to give an example, who is so devoted to tradition, he's such a consensus decisive, if you know his style, he said this, and he said this, and he had him up, if he says that they have to start a base Yaakov, the Chofetz Chaim said it, and the Gerer Rebbe, who was even maybe in a certain sense more traditional, going back to the old customs, if they said it, you have to listen. But if someone else says it, who is given to innovations just like this, drop it out, innovate this, innovate this, innovate this, innovate this, maybe you should stay away. Maybe it's not coming from the same lishma as we spoke about earlier. And therefore, the fear is that some of these prayer groups were not founded with perfectly lishma intentions. I can speak to you about some of the people who founded them, And they were, I'm talking about 30 years ago, they were the old feminists. Often there were connections, I'm sorry to say it, but I have to say the truth, and I'm not trying to be revisionist. I know this was true at the time. I'm not an expert. I'll tell you in a minute why. They were even coming from non-Orthodox places. You know, they had the Orthodox fathers, and they were somewhat traditional, but they at the same time were involved in non-Orthodox institutions, and they were among those at the forefront of these movements when they began. And that's worrisome. It is extraordinarily worrisome when this happens. Moreover, and I'm getting quoting Rabbi Schechter, moreover, there are issues of shul customs remaining. We don't play with shuls, it's especially sensitive. And especially when things are copying the activities of others. Others either to be the non-Jews or even non-observant Jews. Rav Soloveitchik was famous for saying that if you copy a non-observant Jewish custom, it is a serious violation, especially when some of this is connected to worldwide trends. And again, this is considered the idea of the women's prayer groups at the time was often not a completely isolated phenomenon. It was linked together with other manifestations which were not completely in consonance with halacha. I remember it was actually, if I'm not mistaken, about 2.5 years before I signed on this piece of paper, I spoke about it in Shabbos Agadol here in Shul upstairs when I first started in this community, and I said as follows. My fear was, and that individuals who were involved in this endeavor, both here and beyond, were not completely devoted to keeping the halachas in general as they're supposed to be kept. It's not fair to go into particular details. Suffice it to say that some of the accepted halachas that a Jewish woman is supposed to keep, a married Jewish woman in particular, were not being kept by some of these main leaders of this movement. And I quoted the Maharal Miprag. It was Maharal Miprag said that we re-accepted the entire Torah on Purim. Why? It says Kimu v'Kiblu Hayehudim, right? So they re-accepted it. They kept the whole Torah. Yes, the Maharal Miprag. It's not what it says. Finish the pasuk. So the pasuk says they kept it upon themselves to keep the 14th day of Adar and the 15th day of Adar. It doesn't say anything about the rest of the Torah. It says the Maharal something brilliant. You have no right to accept something new before you accept everything which is old. So when they accepted something new, it had implication, they had to accept everything which came before. But before you're running to make new customs and new things we never had before, how about people who are accepting all the other laws to the letter? That was my criticism already going back 2.5 years before I signed my name to this piece of paper. Now, there are issues here which are very, very strong in Rabbi Schechter's piece. Very strong. And he's discussing, for example, the lack of a mechitza in shul. He says that the rav was opposed to mixed seating. And he said at one point that it's yehorig v'al yavar. You got to die and participate in a mixed seating. That sounds extraordinary. That sounds wild. You know why? He said it came from the church. A family that prays together. So they mean together, mixed pews, that's the whole, right? And he felt that the conservatives took it, and reform took it from them, and the conservatives from them, and if someone's going to go in there, he was very strong. He said, if there's the only place where you have the ability to hear the shofar in Rosh Hashanah is mixed seating, stay home. This is written, printed out in the 50s, and no doubt that's what he said. He wrote it, publicly. So Rabbi Schechter was extending this these kinds of manifestations, and he was very, very strong. Now, I made a few references to the fact that I'm not an expert in what's in this whole movement and what's happened to it over all these years. My experience is decades old. So now I know we're almost out of time. In this periodical called Tradition by the Rabbinical Council of America, I'm reading you from the winter 1998 edition. That's what? 12 years ago? 12 years ago. Women's Prayer Service, Theory and Practice, Part one theory. Aryeh and Dov Frimer, two very wonderful Jews, wrote a very lengthy piece on this. Very long. I mean, if you include the footnotes, just you want something to read, you can maybe spend the next 2 weeks or next year reading it. It'll be a bigger expert than I. It has 286 footnotes. And, you know, I'm just letting you know. And the you want to know how long it takes? I'm just telling you, I just want to give you. It begins on page 5, and the page 118. If you have some time, I'll lend it to you. Just want to give it back to me. Okay? There's only one problem with this. It's only part one. Where is part two? 12 years later. I'm still waiting for part two. Part two, to my mind, was going to prove my opinion of part one. In part one, they strive mildly to prove that Rabbi Schechter's position, because you could argue on this point, and argue on this point, and quibble with this, and quibble with that, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And they call Rabbi Soloveitchik, who said, yes, you shouldn't do it, but he doesn't think that the actual word usur, prohibited, should apply to these actions. Okay, I'm not here to quibble with them. And he says that Rabbi Soloveitchik's objection was substantially different from that of the objections raised by the Ritz Rosh Yeshiva. I don't think it's much different. I think it's basically saying the same thing. That they're opposed. Why was he opposed? So I'll just give you a very brief minig beis haKnesset shouldn't be changed. He called it brinksmanship. And I'll read it to you verbatim. It's page 41. If the rabbis gave in on those matters of synagogue practice where there was admittedly some room for flexibility, then they well lay the ground for a call for change in other areas of halacha as well. Areas where there's a little risk or perhaps no room for maneuvering. How would the rabbis respond then? And should the rabbis indeed resist further attempts to change, how would the women cope with the heightened sense of frustration they most likely experience? Absolutely. That's exactly what I'm concerned about. This is not different from what we express it in perhaps in more powerful terms. And he was all afraid there's a was it great, were they worried about more spirituality of Kiva Mitzvahs? Or, consciously or not, public preapprobation, conspicuous religious performance, a sense of equality with men, and if motivating factor was any of the latter, women too would not truly satisfy their religious needs, merely foster increasingly unfulfillable expectations, creating a greater frustration and perhaps even a break with halacha. How smart was my Rebbe? How smart was he? He saw it for what it was. He saw it for what it was, and we know, this is fascinating, which is printed over here. I think I mentioned about the tzitzis. Did we go through this last? I mentioned the tzitzis, right? We're doing the tzitzis with no strings. It's here. The same page, 41. For those who want to see where it is. 41. And his motivation was concerned extended the entire phenomenon of women's prayer groups. What's going on? Right? And it's not really Tefillah B'Tzibur. It's not. And in later years, it was increasingly distraught with the direction the women's prayer groups were taking and their possible impact on Jewish life. Other women were co-opting the services for their own non-halachic social agendas. It might generate egalitarian movement within conservative reform Jewry. Hey, what am I saying all this time? The same thing. I'm not as poetic as my Rebbe. All right? It may weaken the fabric and cohesiveness of the community. And he instructed his students to avoid any formal affiliation between synagogues and the women's prayer groups. Okay? Okay. And this is different than what we saw. I don't think it's much different at all. I just don't think so. And he just goes back to the 70s. I didn't even know it existed in the 70s. I didn't know that he was not happy with the entire idea, and it wasn't done. And the same with Hakafos. Hakafos. Here he says it shouldn't be done. It's a violation of what he called synagogue etiquette. He was very much opposed to it. Okay? And he got more and more opposed as time went on. And women's Megillah reading. We're supposed to talk about this next time. About the Kriyas HaTorah aspect. Much, much more to be said, but I'm already over time. Suffice to say, if someone wants to borrow this, feel free. I'm strongly opposed now as ever. I haven't changed one iota of my opposition. It's only gotten stronger. Same as my Rebbe. It gets stronger and stronger as time goes on. And all those things we predicted have already happened. Not are going to happen. Have already happened. But I'm out of time. I was supposed to speak about this fairly new manifestation called a woman being a leader of, how should I say it, men's and women's prayers for Kabbalah Shabbos. Another manifestation which took place not far from here. I'm not identifying where. 2 blocks away. And what do I say about that? That's 2 weeks away. Come back to the in 2 weeks, and we'll discuss that manifestation before we get to the actual Kriyas HaTorah. Shavua Tov. Mm-hmm.